This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. And as I mentioned on the last episode, over the next week or so, we're going to be bringing you some special episodes, stuff from shows we love, a few of our favorite recent episodes from this podcast, all as we kind of plot and scheme and get ready for a new year with lots of great new stories. So today, we're excited to present an episode of In the Bubble with Andy Slavitt. Andy's been on this show before. You may know his work. He's a White House advisor generally on healthcare policy. Super interesting, super compelling guy. Each week on the show, he's joined by experts, policymakers, journalists, and more to break down everything from the latest COVID wave to gun violence to Supreme Court cases. The show, to my mind, started out as a bit of a COVID pandemic lockdown type show, but it's really evolved into a look at the many crises and challenges that we face, but it doesn't get bogged down in the news cycle. It's really much more about context and perspective and a look at how we can move forward together, which are all wonderful things and things we like on this show as well. So we want to run an episode of In the Bubble that we think you'd like. It's got a nice historical perspective. This is an excerpt from his conversation with filmmaker Ken Burns, the legend. They discuss Ken's 2022 PBS documentary on Benjamin Franklin and how Franklin balanced his libertarian views with scientific and public health reasoning, how Franklin thought about pandemics and public health, and whether he would support a COVID-19 vaccine mandate. They also get a little bit into how Ken Burns thinks about the work of history and what he's learned about this country through his many, many films. So yeah, it's a wonderful conversation, and I can't wait for you to hear it. Of course, you can find more episodes of In the Bubble wherever you get your podcasts or click the link in the episode notes. So here we go. This is an excerpt of the conversation. It's kind of the middle third of the conversation. We'll pick it up with Ken Burns, who started off talking about how he really thinks Ben Franklin is probably the most fascinating character of the 18th century, but that he's had to grapple with the very complicated nature of historical figures and how to see their good actions and their bad actions and them being products of the times versus being called to account for some of their views. So here we go, Ken Burns and Andy Slavitt. This starts with Ken Burns.
History is tragedy, not melodrama. You know, Andy, in melodrama, every hero is perfectly virtuous, every villain is perfectly evil. But that's not the way human beings are. And so when you dig and you scratch the surface of any subject, you find dimension, you find contradiction, you find undertow. And that, in fact, makes for a good story. Yeah. Anywhere you go, it's not in any way diminishing the quality of the tapestry to lift up that carpet and sweep out some of the dirt and say, and this too.
Well, that requires us to do some work and not be reflexive and get past 180 characters. And the fact is, if you can invest several hours and watch one of your documentaries, then you can begin to grapple with it yourself. But as a society, I guess it just has to ask a direct question. You know, how do we deal with historical figures that we idealize in some form, like a Washington or a Franklin or a Jefferson, but have these very in-your-face elements to them that in today's society are intolerable. Is there a right way to wrestle with this? Or where should we come out as a society, and where do we get it wrong?
Well, I think we get it wrong by taking it too far. We get it right by understanding context and understanding that complexity. None of us are perfect. And while, you know, the people that we have revered and put on pedestals are people of their time, that's no excuse whatsoever. And so it's very simple with Confederate monuments. Most of them went up at a period when white rule was being brutally reimposed over the old Confederacy. And, you know, just take them down, put them in a museum, interpret them in a different way. But you can't throw out Thomas Jefferson, and you can't throw out George Washington. Without George, he's central to everything. I mean, the two most important people to the success of the creation of the United States, in my mind, are Washington and Franklin, and everybody understands that. Jefferson articulates it, but even then, Franklin's the editor of it. So Jefferson says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, to be sacred. And Franklin goes, no, to be self-evident. He's a scientist. You know, he's saying, this is just natural, right? That all men are created equal, right? Oops, asterisk, both of them, slave, enslavers, you know. And so I think we have to do it with nuance. It is a tragedy. Human life is a tragedy. No one gets out of it alive. And I think this idea that you can have a switch one way or the other and adjudicate all of this stuff is a road to madness. You know, we like to say that history repeats itself. It never has. It's just that human nature never changes, Andy. Never changes. You know, the Ecclesiastes, that's the Old Testament, right? It says, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun, which means that we can see in ourselves as well as in those past figures the same quantities of greed, but also generosity, of purience, but also puritanism. And so, you know, we just have to do that. You can't be a parent, for example, if you are not willing to tolerate contradiction. And that, unfortunately, we live in a computer and media age in which everything is binary.
Yes.
You know, rich or poor, gay or straight, you know, red state, blue state, whatever it is, we're certain that if we can just label the other, and there is no other, there's just right. us.
Oh, and do we cling too closely to this great man theory?
Yeah, way too much. And so what we've tried to do in our films is balance it with a bottom-up view and also to expose the, you know, I made a documentary 25 years ago on Thomas Jefferson, you know, and he didn't get away unscathed for the hypocrisies in his life, but he did distill a century of Enlightenment thinking into, to me, the second greatest sentence in the English language. The first is, I love you, but the other one is, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And he didn't follow John Locke and say property. Happiness was the pursuit of lifelong learning in a place in which you trusted people to govern themselves. And the more important word in that phrase is pursuit. This is something you do. You're trying to do. You're never going to get there.
Let's talk a little bit about science and the role science plays in this, because, you know, I think we tend to think of these times as being very colored by faith, by being very colored by the puritanical element. Certainly, you know, this is in Franklin's childhood, but in the whole context of the Revolution. Yet Franklin comes onto the scene and, you know, he's a person of science. And how does that context fit? How well accepted was that? And really where I want to go with that a little bit, Ken, is the relationship that we have. I think the sometimes very uneasy relationship we have as Americans with science and scientists.
Yeah, no, I think there was much broader acceptance. This is the Age of Enlightenment. This is, you know, coming out of the Dark Ages into a Renaissance and then a period of exploration and enlightenment. And so we tend to think that as either or, again, a kind of binary presumption. I was going to say assumption, but it's a presumption. And so you have really complex things. He's born in Boston, into a very rigid, hierarchical Puritan society run by the Mather clan. And it's so ironic because, of course, they established the Massachusetts Bay Colony almost a century before Franklin's birth, to establish religious freedom from the persecution they are experiencing in Europe and in England. And people fled from them, like Anne Hutchinson and Roger Williams, to begin in Rhode Island and New York and other places, more liberal places, and more liberal interpretations of Christian doctrine. And then, of course, he runs away to Pennsylvania, which is Quakers, which is even a bigger layer of tolerance. But something in him has been inventive since the very beginning. He's, you know, he basically invented kind of parasailing. I mean, he let sail pull himself along a pond. He invented some rudimentary flippers when he was a kid to do stuff. So he's this inventive and restless mind. He's first a printer. That's what he knows how to do. And that's a kind of, as one of our consultants, Joyce Chapin says, you know, that's hyper literate. You're setting type upside down and backwards. And you're also carrying this stuff. So he's big and strong and strapping. And he's hyper literate and he's reading stuff. He's getting exposure. So he's a publisher. He's a great writer. He's a humorist. He invents a kind of an American humor. And then he retires. He's a very successful businessman and he retires to pursue science. And that's that. This was a noble pursuit. And you know what? In the 18th century, the world knows only one American, and that's Benjamin Franklin. There's nobody else. They have no idea where America is. God forbid where Philadelphia is or Pennsylvania or whatever it is. But they know of this one guy, the modern Prometheus, the man who tamed electricity, who's saving lives practically with a lightning rod, who's invented a stove, who invents bifocals, all of these things from a restless and exploring scientific mind, which he's also applying in very enlightenment ways to his own self and his own relationship to God, too, because these are not mutually exclusive. People are, including popes and religious figures, trying to deal with science as well, and trying to understand the fact that this new age has said, no, the sun doesn't revolve around the earth. It's actually a little bit different than that. And may we propose you think about your universe in new ways. And so this is an exciting time to be alive. It's very fluid, we would say today. And that's what I think we don't appreciate. We just look back, powdered wigs, you know, breaches, you know, and we just figure we know everything. And the great arrogance of the present is that we think we're better than the people in the past because we've survived. And in fact, you know, the wonderful, for me, conversation we're having today, we sort of pretend to ourselves that this is something new. People for 10,000 years have been having exquisitely wonderful conversations and is with the same depth and profundity as you and I could ever achieve in an hour's conversation.
Well, it's funny. I find that we do think we're superior. We've got superior knowledge. And yet we also, to your point about the great man theory, we also hold certain periods of time the people to be exceptionally special. And to some extent, almost at a level of like they're communicating with God to have written the Constitution or have you know, achieved some great victory in the Civil War, or Muhammad Ali to overcome all the things he's overcome. And we're fascinated with these people because I think to some extent we wonder how it's possible that they do this.
But it's also because we're curious, and our fanzines tell us this all the time, at how much they're like us too, right? That is to say, you know, we talk about heroes and we've got a really perverted view right now that they're perfect. And of course, they're not perfect. They are flawed. The Greeks invented the concept and it wasn't to show perfection. You know, Achilles right. had his heel and his hubris to go along with his great strengths. So these are moral stories that are put in front of us so that we can be reminded that these godlike figures, these great men, you know, these exceptional people are actually going through stuff that we go through too. So they're lessons for us. We're supposed to learn in the story of Achilles. We're supposed to learn, it seems to me, and be inspired by the story of Muhammad Ali. But the thing that makes them more interesting to me is to remind us that, you know, Muhammad Ali was incredibly unfaithful. He abandoned Malcolm X. He spoke about his greatest rival, indeed many of his rivals, with the Jim Crow language that a white racist would use. I mean, he just did that. And then he died the most beloved person on the planet. So there, you deal with that, right? And right. So I like that. I like that stuff. And it allows us to not be so instantaneously sure that we can make a judgment.
It's a great subtitle, by the way, for your documentaries. You deal with it.
You deal with it. Yeah. No, well, I've got a t-shirt that was made up by one of my colleagues. We invite all sorts of folks to criticize our films, scholars and whatever during the course of it. And inevitably you get some tedious person who wants you to make some other thing that you're not doing, even though you've explained the contours of it. And this is early on when I'm sure it looks terrible, but it says, make your own effing film, right? And I've never had the courage to put it on and to go to one of those meetings. But there is that kind of sense that, like, you have to just deal with what we're going to do. I love the fact that people criticize my films, particularly the long ones, like Baseball and Jazz and Civil War, for what we left out. Wait a second, 18 and a half hours was not enough for you? You don't think this is boring? You're just pissed off because I left out this World Series or this general or this battle? And you go, yeah, we're storytellers, we're not encyclopedias. And I'm totally happy to answer all of those letters with enthusiasm right. and generosity and tolerance.
And point them to Wikipedia.
Hey there, Jody here, and I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a brand new season. This is their 13th season, and the show just keeps getting better. Now, I don't know if you know, but Ear Hustle is the show about life inside prison, but it is not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons, and now they have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships inside prison, and stories of incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. These are stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. I'll be listening, and I hope you will too. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
In the midst of all of the things that are going on, and frankly, the very dynamic life lived at a time that I think, you know, you remind us does not necessarily feel more special than our own time, something does happen, and that is, like our own times, we have a pandemic. And you bring us back 400 years to look at this other pandemic. I wonder if we could play a first clip of that from your documentary.
Smallpox was really the scourge of the 18th century. It's an awful, awful disease that disfigured a person. This kind of devastating specter that entered communities. You sickened and died very quickly. There was no cure for it. It could reach epidemic. It was very contagious. People died in the hundreds. And Franklin was always involved with this issue throughout his life for some tragic reasons. It began when he was a boy in Boston. Boston had a strong Puritan influence, very religious. In those days, many religious figures also dabbled in science. Cotton Mather was the leading cleric in the town. Mather's own family had been devastated by both measles and smallpox. So when a smallpox epidemic came to Boston in the early 1720s, a slave of Mather's, an African slave, told him that in Africa there was something called inoculation, which basically meant giving a small amount of the illness, injecting it in a person, in the hope that that would then deter a full onslaught of the disease. Now, of course, to many people, this was a crazy idea. Why would you introduce this body of disease into a healthy body? But Cotton Mather was interested in it, and he had read about it, and he thought, I'm going to try it. The epidemic spread. People began dropping like flies. Cotton Mather started inoculating people. In the end, of course, many fewer people, percentage-wise, who had been inoculated, perished from the disease. But Benjamin Franklin went on to have a tragic association with it years later when a smallpox epidemic came to Philadelphia.
Well, first, let me just say that this is a special clip that we created out of the outs. We deal with this story very briefly in the film, but I think with the same resonance that you're getting at, Andy. But this is an extended piece for Unum, our sort of curated website, which is trying to deal with the evergreen topics of American history. And of course, what could be more evergreen right now? But it's so interesting that this project was begun well before the pandemic started.
That was what I was going to mention.
And almost every film I've ever made has come out, and I've always, you know, promoted them by saying, what if I told you I was making a film about this, 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 and this, and you'd say I'd been talking about the present moment. It's true about Vietnam. It's true about Prohibition. It's true about every film that I've done where you just cannot believe, like Ecclesiastes, that there is nothing new under the sun. And so this comes to us at a time when we're grappling with that. What I find so interesting is that you have, I don't want to say a religious class, but a group of people who are people of faith, professional people of faith, who are dabbling. Philip Dre's comment maybe isn't right. I mean, you're not dabbling if you're taking the advice, and this I find incredibly ironic because people believe in this white supremacy, you know, beyond measure, that the African slave could, in fact, give them a hint about how they might go about mitigating this impossibly devastating disease of smallpox.
Especially such a primitive sounding solution.
Well, this is, you know, this is the thing. I mean, I remember my dad was an anthropologist, and he would tell me when I was a young boy, all these stories that would lit me up. He said, you know why the Christians lost the crusade? It's because the wounds were treated with old and stale and moldy bread by the Saracens. So they were basically had invented penicillin, you know, a couple of millennia before penicillin, right? Or a millennia before penicillin. You know, these are kinds of the stuff that you just want to disrupt in history. These assumptions, this superficial, conventional, the danger of that conventional wisdom. And look where we are, saturated with media and slaves to conventional wisdom. The most superficial, the most wrong disinformation that you could possibly imagine. And so what you have in the 18th century is people getting their sources from a wide variety of stuff, but they're willing to look at this and go, okay, I don't want to lose any more kids. I don't want to lose any more people in my family. I don't want to lose any more people in my congregation. Why can't we try it? And there is a little bit of wisdom in saying, if you give a little bit of this disease and your body knows how to fight it, It's a big inoculation is different from vaccination. I mean, it's an assault, right? You're getting smallpox in a small quantity, and your body is figuring out how to fight it. And then it becomes resistant to all forms of smallpox. It's just brilliant.
I want to look at the inoculation, but before we do, maybe you could set a little bit of context, if you don't mind, about smallpox itself at the time. How widespread was it? How disruptive was it? What were public attitudes like?
It's a plague. You know, it's a scourge, as Philip Dre says. It's when it comes, and it comes in waves, and it comes at different times, and you're free of it. It's in different places, and it just concentrates, and it, you know, it's deadly. It's deadly, and it's beyond disfiguring, Andy. I mean, it's, you know, there's Ebola is kind of the boogeyman now of what would happen. And, you know, your skin fills with these sores and pus, they break. It's just devastating. And it's devastating native populations. It's devastating all sorts of, populations in the colonies, then the colonies of that would become the United States. It's horrific scourge.
And is your sense that this was considered something that was you just had to live with, or was your sense different? I mean, I'm struck by this, and you do show images that it was unavoidable if someone were to contract smallpox. Whereas you look at our pandemic, COVID-19, its lethality is in its invisibility.
Yeah, Yeah. So I don't know. I think, you know, clearly it's a much more religious time in terms of your commending. I mean, the whole idea of the Puritans is it has nothing to do with what you do here. It's just God's grace is whatever it is. And it's Franklin who's going to suggest a more existential, a kind of what would be called, adopted by most of the founders, a kind of deism in which, you know, you do good works and you prove to him, always a him, capital H, of that. So I think there's various things. And what the Enlightenment has helped do is increase the role of science in everybody's life. And so I think what you're having is just the convincing of people to get over the obvious barrier you asked in your previous question. What? You're telling me I should give a little bit of the disease? We're way past that now. And it's been captured by people for the, you know, we've had vaccine mandates for years. You can't go to public school without polio and rubella and mumps and measles, all of that sort of stuff we've been doing. You can't serve in the armed forces. And so all of a sudden this one just became, because it could in our society, a political hot potato. But you still have a job of convincing people that this is actually the way you're going to go if you're in the 18th century and you don't want to get the thing that Uncle Harry got.
Well, I want to come back and talk a little bit about that hesitancy and how even some of Franklin's words or themes are either used or misused, depending on how, what you might tell us. But let's look at inoculations. I want to play another clip where inoculations, which are kind of an early forerunner idea of a type of vaccines, you know, come to play.
At the time Frankie was a child, the concept of inoculation had just been promulgated. And Franklin was one of the few people in the colonies who was 100% behind inoculation. He believed in it.
Benjamin Franklin was an early proponent of inoculation. He knew that it worked, but Frankie was often sick as a young child and wasn't inoculated.
Tragically, there was a smallpox outbreak in Philadelphia when Frankie was 4 years old. And it was thought that because he had a very bad cold at the time, they should hold off until he recovered enough to be able to withstand the assault on his system that inoculation would provide. He never was inoculated. He contracted smallpox and he died. Franklin never forgave himself. For Deborah and Benjamin Franklin, the huge tragedy of their lives was the death of Frankie.
This was a devastating blow to Debbie and Benjamin Franklin himself. Never could think about Frankie without feeling a certain wistfulness. And at moments in Benjamin Franklin's subsequent life, when he would see young boys playing who were the age that Frankie would have been, he always thought what a promising young boy he had been and what a loss he had suffered.
My interpretation from this clip is that the loss of his son cemented his belief in inoculation.
I think that belief was already cemented, Andy. I think what happened, it was just purely one of those tragic things, which is he's got a super bad cold. We don't want to make it worse. He's been frail. We don't want to make it worse by the trial that inoculation would give to his body, right? This would be a serious reaction. So they're just going to hold off before they inoculate him, but it's too late. And so there's a sense of, just as so many families in the last, you know, 2 years, literally 2 years. I remember it's 2 years ago today, I just trimmed my sails. I said, I'm going home. You know, I was on the road and I said, I think I'm going home. I think that a lot of people have gone, oops, I wish I'd done that. I wish I'd known. I wish I hadn't believed this or heard that or whatever it might be, that I had selfishly avoided it or I'd proselytized against it for some reason. And I think there's a kind of circumstantial sadness. He was already a scientist and committed to this. This was a devastating blow just because it was, here was a guy who was not against it for any reason. He was for it.
It's interesting, Ken, and I don't know whether or not Franklin was would meet this definition, but there is a certain belief system and action system which goes a little bit something like vaccination for thee, but not for me.
Not for him. He's committed to it. It's just, I think it's the Frankie's, just his general frailness and the fact that he has a particularly bad cold. So we'll wait until he's better and then we'll inoculate him. But it's too late. It's oops. Just as it's, there are some people who are, as you know, immunocompromised. And there's an article in the paper today about how for the immunocompromised, the place that had given them some solace, their own congregations, are now places of danger. And so what kind of further isolation is enforced by the fact that you can't go worship God the way you wish to worship God because of your state and your inability to get vaccinated to protect yourself.
Let's watch the third clip.
Franklin had to explain publicly that he had failed to have the child inoculated against smallpox, and that giving the inoculation would have really compromised his health. This must have hurt incredibly to have to talk about the death of your child in your own newspaper.
This beautiful son named Frankie, we have a portrait of him that Franklin commissioned. And it really shapes Franklin for the rest of his life, that beautiful little son that he lost.
There is a stereotype that people in the past couldn't possibly really have cared about their children because the death rate was higher, and that is just completely bogus. Of course they did. Of course they did. We know that people felt very deeply when children died and memorialized them. Frankie was very much a very wanted child. They had to pick a terrible option and then regret that for the rest of their lives.
Franklin did his part eventually to try to convince people to take it seriously and inoculate. He always wrote very passionately about the need for parents to inoculate their children.
Surely parents will no longer refuse to accept and thankfully use a discovery God in his mercy has been pleased to bless mankind with, whereby some check may now be put to the ravages that cruel disease has been accustomed to make. For the loss of 1 in 10 thereby is not merely the loss of so many persons, but the accumulated loss of all the children and children's children the deceased might have had, multiplied by successive generations. Benjamin Franklin.
I really was so glad that you made sure that you had that point made, that the loss of a child actually does feel the same way it would feel to us today.
Well, I think in almost all of our considerations in politics, we neglect what Franklin is bringing up here, which is potentiality. You know, who is going to be the next Albert Einstein? No one, but who will be this? Who will be that? And, you know, are you certain it will come from the privileged precincts? Why are we not investing in all human beings? And so I think just as it said that an amputee still has sensation in the missing limb, so too the missing people from a civil war, from death. My mother died when I was 11 of cancer. There's not a day when I don't think about that. I've been without a mother. It's coming up on 57 years. You know, that's way too long to be without a mother. But I also, her death transformed me. My potentiality increased because I write about people who are dead. I wake the dead. And it's really a conversation with a long departed person who left before I was 12 years old. So all of us are dealing with the absence of something. And that's the great lesson of life is loss. Where, as I said, none of us are getting out of this alive. And I think this focuses it in an important way. And I know I've strayed from your question, but I think there's a much larger spiritual, metaphysical dimension to this that can be understood and shared by the purely rational and scientific. and also by the people who have deeply held religious beliefs. And I find it so interesting in this period now where we are so superficially divided by these things that cause deep, deep divisions, even though the differences are superficial and artificial, that you can have a period of time which could teach us, really, really actually educate us to the fact that you had clergymen and scientists working together in support of this. You had tragedy and the possibility to escape the specific gravity of tragedy, and that we have a value for human life that we ourselves laud our own, you know, addiction to, and yet we don't prove it with our actions. We don't ever prove it with our actions. And I think that one of the great lessons that can come, and lesson sounds like there'll be a test on Tuesday, or that, you know, you're shamed by this. One of the great moments of the past is this ability to go, this is so much like now. This is so much like me. You know, the poignancy. I mean, Benjamin Franklin is a great stylist and a great writer, and he knows as a scientist that he still is going to yield, as Einstein did, the ultimate experiment to God.
Well, I think what's beautiful about a lot of your work, Ken, is you figure out how to help us help ourselves drop our guards down and relate to something at a very universal level, like loss and how we deal with loss. And, you know, in those moments when we witness somebody going through something like this, which all of us experience, it does cause us, even if it's only temporary, and I'll grant you that life has a way of sucking us back into these poles, or however we define ourselves, that for these moments, I think maybe we don't, whether we realize it or not, we are feeling something and we're connecting to something. And a lot of us find that missing right now.
Yeah, I was sent yesterday, coincidentally, Andy, by a friend, a text that included a picture of an African-American man holding up a Ku Klux Klan hood and cape. And the subsequent attached story, very brief, was essentially that this person had gotten to know and engaged in a multi-year dialogue with a Klansman, who in the course of that understood the essential humanity of the black person he found so reprehensible. And that he left the Klan and sort of shed everything. And the tangible manifestation of that was the hood and the robe that he bequeathed to a black man, the target of that animus, along with Jews and Catholics and, you know, whatever else the crazies hate. And then you realize, you know, I've said this a few years ago, I started saying this, that I've had the great privilege of working nearly 50 years telling stories about the U.S., but I've also had the privilege of telling stories about us. That is to say, the lowercase two-letter plural pronoun, all of the intimacy of us and all of the majesty and the complexity and the contradiction, as we've talked about, and the controversy of the U.S. And what I've learned in nearly a half a century of doing this is that there's no them. There's no them. There's only us. And whenever anyone tells you there is a them, run away. There's just no them. It's only us. And this is where we get ourselves tied in all of our religious traditions. All of them understand that fundamental thing, however corrupted they become in the course of their dogmatic dispersal, right? They have at their heart the possibility of the individual, of us, to improve and see each other with the same love.
Okay, that's a taste of the conversation between Andy Slavitt and Ken Burns on the podcast In the Bubble. The full episode is available on their feed. I recommend you go listen to it, and many other great conversations from that show. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Just search In the Bubble, or you can click on the link in our show notes. By the way, if there are other podcasts that you listen to that you think might be worth highlighting in our feed, let us know. We like doing this from time to time. Or let us know what you thought of this. Email us at thisdaypod@gmail.com. All right. My name is Jody Avergan. On behalf of Nikki and Kelly and everyone else on the show, thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Radiotopia from PR.